everybody, and welcome to another edition of the World Football Index South American Football Show. Happily, I'm back at home again, and no more of that North American soccer stuff. I'm staying here from here on in. So, as always, of the usual panel of Adam Brannan, Simon Edwards, and Austin Miller. Austin, how are you this evening? All well in the world of Palmeiras?
Okay, for the record, I had an answer to your question that did not involve Palmeiras whatsoever. I was going to talk about the Chicago weather. It's warm, which is a rarity in February. You brought it up, so hands up from me over here.
Fair play. So you're all happy, and you've got mild weather, and everything's good.
It's terrific. Yeah, 60 degrees Fahrenheit here in the middle of February. Never see that.
Coat weather, that guy, isn't it?
I was in t-shirt and shorts today.
Ah, dear. And second up in Chile, we have, and it's certainly not Chile there, is Adam Brannan. How are you, Adam, this evening? Or maybe you're not.
Sorry, Dave. No, it was just... I'm not really talking to you at the moment after you appeared on the North American soccer show.
Well, you see, this is the problem. I did it under duress. I was coerced into this. It's all Dylan Baker's fault. I did put a tweet out apologizing to all Americans for my abysmal performance of knowing feck all about their football and really not really caring either.
It's our soccer.
Sorry. Forget about soccer. It's the last time it'll ever be used in this pod. That's it. It's over. Simon, bring sanity back to us. How are you this evening? You're just on 11 pieces of me, which was excellent. How's things?
Yeah, good. It's good. I'm doing an all day podcast marathon. Yeah, no, good. Good. Yeah. Sanity in Colombia. That's not usually associated, but I'll take it. It's nice. Changing the world opinions one podcast at a time.
Well, we're about to shatter that as we go along, so we may as well start in a positive before it all goes downhill or goes south, as the story goes. So let's start off with Copa Libertadores, and we had the four rounds of games this week. I think the best place to start, which won't take us very long, was Botafogo against Olympia. I'll let Austin have a crack at this one. Really uninspiring stuff from Botafogo. I think, you know, we're both in agreement they could be the new Sao Paulo of this tournament. They just won't go away, and they're hardly inspiring. And one hopes that Olympia will wipe the floor with them next week. Thoughts, Austin?
You would hope so, but I don't know that Olympia has really shown us anything in their two rounds that they can wipe the floor with Botafogo. This is a Botafogo team that is playing pretty reserved. They're sitting back. You know, they've allowed their midfield playmakers to try and make things happen. Walter Montillo, the Argentine that they brought in from China for this year, went off injured in this match at about 16 minutes. So that's really something to watch for going forward, you know, what his status is going to be. If he's out and Camilo is really the only midfield playmaker for Fogão, I think you're going to see them sit back and try to defend their way through this second leg. It was an uninspiring performance, the goal being the exception. I really liked the goal from Rodrigo Pimpão. Nice little bicycle kick from the, you know, about 12 yards out. That was top class. I'll give him credit for that. But other than that, it's Botafogo. They kept a clean sheet. I think you'd like to do that at home. We'll see if they can get Joel Carli back for the second leg. He was kind of their center back key last year. He's yet to play in the Libertadores for them this year. He would be huge for them going forward as far as keeping a clean sheet when they go to Paraguay. And they're also down to their third string goalkeeper. Jefferson, who used to be Brazil's number one, has been out for over a year now, it feels like, at least 9 months. Gachito Fernandes, the Paraguayan, was brought in this past January to fill that hole. He went down with a training injury a couple days back, so Helton Leite, who was their third-string goalkeeper, actually started this match and kept that clean sheet. We'll see if it's Gachito or Helton Leite going forward, but this defense has been strong. You know, you have to give them credit for that. Overall, in their two rounds, they've done enough to get through. They haven't been inspiring, but they've done enough. And sometimes, you know, teams deserve credit for that, even if it isn't the most entertaining or the most dramatic. I don't think they're very good, but I also don't think Botafogo are very flawed. You know, they don't scare me, but there's also nothing that I feel like I can attack that they certainly have a weakness at.
No, indeed. And I know that probably the rest of you watched the game that clashed with this, but it just, you know, I stuck with it. I think you gave up on it. I just wasn't inspired at all by it.
Yeah, I watched some of the game. Not great. Roger up front. I like the way they say it in Spanish. Roger, Roger. They love saying his name. But for me, Camilo, the number 10 for Botafogo, was pretty impressive. He's got nice technique. He pings the ball around nicely. So for me, he was one of the bright spots in the team in a game, which was, you know, it was two well-established sides, kind of not showing anything particularly exciting, but kind of pushing against each other. And it'd be interesting to see how things develop in the second leg. For me, it was kind of an interesting game. I seem to like the boring games. I don't know if I'd say I liked it, but it was quite an interesting game for me, and I'll be interested to see how things develop in the second leg. But for me, the standout was Camilo, the number 10 for Botafogo. He looked a bit classy in a bit of a flat game.
You're a fan of the nutritional tactical battle.
Yeah, I don't know. For me, it's just quite interesting. Obviously, there's always fun when goals go flying in and defences are terrible, but there's also something quite interesting of seeing two teams kind of trying to work each other out. So there were some interesting moments in the game.
Well, let's see if we can entice Adam into more than a one-sentence response here and see whether he can forgive me for my North American appearance. The other game at the same time was the complete opposite. We had a 3-3 draw between Paranesi and Capiata. Adam, your thoughts on this one? It was a rip-roaring Copa Libertadores tie.
Yeah, this was a fantastic game. No, I'm starting to think maybe if the new Independiente de Valle of the Libertadores, they just seemed never to give up. They kept in this game despite going behind a couple of times. You know, it was a cracking second half, especially. And what I really love about these Paraguayans is that they don't seem to have any fear. Especially away from home, you know, they've now scored 6 goals in their 2 matches away from home. It'd be interesting to see if back at home they can eliminate their defensive frailties, because that still might be the thing that costs them. Austin, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think Capiatá are fun for this competition because, as you said, they're not afraid to go forward and they're also not really capable of defending. So they really promise goals in just about every time they touch the pitch. So that's certainly entertaining to watch from a fan's perspective. This was a really interesting match because it felt like it swung multiple times. Paranaense scored early on a free kick that was well taken by Felipe Jadós, but also poorly defended by Capiatá. I believe it was you, Adam, who said it looked like they'd never built a free kick wall before. So they allowed Jadós to find the side netting there. But then Capiatá got one right back before halftime, so that kind of swung things back in their favor. And then lo and behold, they were 2-1 up through Gonzalez in the second half. Then they get a man sent off. Jadós gets a penalty for Paranaense to put it 2-2. And then Pablo puts one in for Paranaense there at the end, and it looks like Paranaense are going to take this 3-2. And I was about to say that'd still be a pretty good result for Capiatá, and then they snagged one right at the death, 89th minute from Gonzalez. So they're in really good position going forward in this tie. It just felt like Paranaense kind of let their opportunity wasted. You cannot let the opposing team get back in when you're 3-2 up at home. You have to hold that advantage before you go to the road leg, and they weren't able to do that. Felipe Jadós was the player who stood out for me, for Paranaense, had a pair of goals in this match. He brought over from Club Bruges in Belgium beforehand this season in January, and he's impressed me by what I've seen from him so far. You know, it's interesting. Penalties probably won't be in play here, which will take out that advantage of Weverton that we've talked about, but it's really all poised for this next match. The way Capiatá defends, you really don't know what will happen. And the way that their home crowd has shown up in their first 2 rounds so far, I think we'll be treated to a pretty good atmosphere when these two teams get back at it on Wednesday.
Yeah, Felipe Jadós, he impressed me as well. Although, well, he stood out to me. I'm not sure really he impressed me that much. I was saying to you pre-pod, you know, I feel that he's a player who is maybe a little bit too greedy. There was many opportunities in that game where he decided to shoot instead of maybe laying it off to a teammate in a better position. And I think it's those kind of decision-making in the final third where you can see maybe a player like that struggled in Europe. And, you know, he was only in the Belgium league. So I do wonder just how much quality he actually has. And maybe it's not such a great thing that he did stand out in this game.
I think that's fair, but the counterpoint is, who else is going to do it for Paranaense? Yeah, I don't think this is a very strong squad. Grafich is currently their lead striker at age 38. You know, so I don't know that Paranaense really has that many other options. And they might go as far as Jadós can take them in this tournament, which probably won't be particularly far. They might make the group stage, but it's kind of hard to see them getting out of that. They'd be put into Flamengo's group. So Yeah, I think it's valid concern, but definitely you have to consider that. I don't think Podonansky really has any other options at this point. I just don't think it's a very talented squad top to bottom. I think they've lost some pieces through this transfer window. And when a lot of teams will, you know, kind of reload before the Libertadores, they really struggle to do that outside really of Gidos.
Simon, did you pick up much of this one? It was a great game. Obviously, you've seen the highlights. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, for me, again, obviously, Gidos is the guy who stood out, not just because he has kind of curly Afro hair and a number 10 shirt. You know, as a Colombian fan, obviously that catches my attention. But he also, I think Austin's right. I think in a kind of a flat team like Paranaense, which depend upon a solid defense, although they definitely didn't have one today, and Graffiti getting a goal here and there, I think having a charismatic, selfish, at times, attacking midfielder may be important for them in terms of making the difference. Just because, him aside, in previous games, they haven't looked quite as dangerous. Whereas, you know, the guy got two goals. Obviously, one was a penalty. But yeah, for me, he made an impression. And in quite a flat team, I think that might be important. And maybe the difference in the second leg, we'll have to see. I think maybe on the break, he could be dangerous when chances may be less. You'd expect chances to be less after a 3-2 draw. So maybe he'll make the difference in the second leg with a bit of moments of creativity and perhaps selfishness. But you know, every team needs a selfish player here and there.
I take it we would all be in agreement that Cabiate would be in the box seat for this one at home, although we saw in the last round that it's maybe foolish to think like that. But the three away goals, Austin, I take it you don't see a way back for Paranaense.
I definitely see a way back for them. It's just that's going to hinge on Capiatá letting them back in it. I don't think Paranaense are good enough to go and take this match. But if Capiatá decide that they're just not going to use their defense again, then I think Paranaense can absolutely get back in this tie. It would sit a little past 50-50 for Capiatá to me, but I think there's definitely a way for Paranaense to get back, even though I would probably take Capiatá just because I just don't think Paranaense really have the playmakers to get them back into it.
And Adam, would you echo those, or do you see it any way different?
It's just the fact that the Paraguayans have three away goals. So that's going to prove very handy. Basically, any result, apart from a defeat, obviously takes them through. Or, you know, it's going to be unlikely, you know, there's going to be another 3-3 or a 4-4. Yeah, I think they should be confident going into the second leg.
Yeah, and I think we've got Roberto coming on next week as well after the second leg. So it'll be interesting to see his thoughts on the Paraguayans thus far. Simon, yourself, again, anything different on it? Or are you nailing your colours to the mast for Capiatá?
No, I don't know. I think it might be a closer game. And I think Paranaense have a chance. Again, we've got Graffiti popping up from a cross or maybe a long-range effort, maybe a free kick from Guedos. I wouldn't be surprised if Paranaense make it through, although Capiatá have been impressive and have made things happen. So I think there's a chance. I might go against and I might go for Paranaense in this game.
You Brazilian lover, you.
But listen, he just likes on. Him at number 10. That's what he likes. He thinks Gidos is going to just take it and score a hat trick.
A creative number 10 with an afro. Ice, you know, Valderrama effect. What can I say?
If you want to know what we're talking about, 11 pieces of meal will be released the day after this and all will be revealed. Am I right, Simon?
Just a team of playmakers. Team of number 10. I've got a soft, I can't resist.
It was an enjoyable listen. But listen, let's move forward into Junior against Atletico Tucumán, who decided to arrive early for this one, Adam. What was your thoughts? They ended up going down 1-0, but I don't think they'll be too unhappy by it.
No, well, without the entertainment that they provided us with last time, you know, this time that they actually turned up on time meant that we didn't get the joy we got last time. So the game was a little bit of a disappointment. I found it a little bit dull, to be honest. Maybe Simon loved it. I don't know. Be interested to hear his views, especially as it involved the Colombian team. But I think Tucumán probably are going to regret not getting an away goal in this game. Junior are very solid at the back, as they proved in this competition and in recent years as well. They don't seem to let in too many goals. The other strange thing about this game was the fact that, you know, and I know that Simon will probably explain the reasons why in a minute, but the fact that Junior were playing this in Cartagena, rather than Barranquilla. It was a really strange atmosphere. You know, the match was played in front of a really sparse crowd, and it just added to the feel of the game not being particularly interesting. And it always looked like, you know, one goal would win it, and that's exactly how it turned out.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I think the context of the game, the stadium, the heat, I think all played into making it quite flat. In Colombia, there's a team called Jaguares who play in Monteria, and their stadium is basically in what looks like an African savannah. They've got a stand one side, the rest is just like desert. And every time there's a game there, just don't even bother watching, because it will be terrible because of the heat. It's dry. It's just flat, not a huge crowd. And the games are always awful. And I think this game had some of that. The game was played in Cartagena, which again is only 1.5-2 hours along the coast from Barranquilla. But very, very few fans made the journey, which is really disappointing because it's quite easy. You get on a bus, maybe $10 at the stadium. But I think the heat and the lack of supporters, there were a few there, but nowhere near, it wasn't a high energy game at all. And I think the crowd and the heat had a lot to do with that. The game was early evening. It was one of the earlier games. So it was pretty hot, pretty humid in Cartagena. And I think the game really reflected that. 1-0 to Junior. The goal they scored was nice. It was a nice bit of passing play. Crossed in and Aponsa towed it in. Tucumán had a few chances, especially once Junior had scored, hit the post from a long-range effort. Yeah, I think Junior will be happy with the result. Obviously, I think the atmosphere in for the Tucumán home leg will be a lot more passionate, a lot more animated. There'll be a lot more people there. So I think Junior are going to have a tough game. The defences look good. They're not always the most organised, but they pass the ball quite well in spells. Not a game I particularly enjoyed, actually. You know, it was low scoring, which is fantastic, obviously. But it was also very flat and there wasn't that much happening. So I think the environment, the heat, the crowd contributed to a game that was a bit flat. But in the end, Junior have come out of it with a decent result. If they score in the second leg, then they'll be confident of going through. And I think they can. They've had a few good moves, some nice passing. So I'm confident that Junior could probably get the result they need in the second leg.
I personally wish that the goal would have come earlier in this match. It came in the 72nd minute there for Junior. I felt like that really opened things up and Tucumán started to go forward and create chances. And the last 20 or so minutes of this match were far, far better than the first 70. Which I would echo what both Adam and Simon said here, that it was rather dull. It didn't do a lot. Not a ton of chances were created. I think Tucumán won't be happy with this result, obviously, but I think they will feel that they can turn it around in that second leg, as we saw when they played El Nacional in the past round. They're going to have a great atmosphere in Argentina. So I'm very excited for that, especially considering, as we've discussed, the atmosphere that was there in Cartagena for this one. So this one won't rank highly on my end-of-year list of the best Libertadores matches. In fact, it'll probably rank towards the bottom. But Junior got what they needed to do, and as Simon said, if they can get a goal in the next leg, they'll probably be sitting pretty for heading through to the group stage.
No, indeed. And, you know, moving on into the last game and my soft spot for the strongest, they got a 1-1 draw at Unión Española. A satisfactory result, I would say, Simon, for this one. You know, going back to La Paz, you've got to pin them as favourites, don't you?
Yeah, no, I would think so. And not only La Paz, in previous years you would say La Paz would be the main reason why you might back the strongest. But this year they're actually really, really good. They've been really impressive. Pablo Escobar, obviously, great technique. The strongest goal came from some really nice work from Escobar. Cut inside and pinged across to the far post. It was headed across by Ayala. And then Chumacero ducked in front of the defender to put the strongest ahead. And Chumacero is an amazing player. It's crazy that he's still playing for the strongest, really. Obviously, the strongest is a big side in Bolivia, but Bolivia is Bolivia. And it's, you know, it's not one of the bigger leagues in South America. And he's an excellent player. He works so hard in defense. There were moments in the game where the strongest would lose the ball. There wasn't a great deal of danger. But you see him sprinting full pace, 30, 40, 50 yards to get back into position. And it's like, well, you know, that really set the tone for the team. But I think, yeah, the strongest have got to be happy. And I think they are probably the better team. Unión Española were pressing and pressing towards the end. The goal was really nice. Piñares down the left beat a few players, Costa in and Churin equalized right in the last minute. Obviously, that's an important goal for Unión Española, keeps them in the tie. But as we've seen, playing in the altitude against the strongest, and it's the strongest side that can keep the ball, can be dangerous. They could have scored many, many more goals in the previous round. So the strongest for me, if you want to put a bet on the Libertadores, it's going to be a massive outside bet. But the strongest, having the home games in La Paz being actually really quite good, if you want to put an outside bet, you might make a good amount of money on the strongest to win the whole tournament. And again, that's a massive shout at this stage. Nobody would back the strongest on paper. But for me, they have some interesting players and they're actually really good. Plus the altitude. Yeah, I would. They'd be very disappointed if they don't make it through in the second leg. Unión Española are going to have to work very, very, very hard to even maintain parity against a decent side with a big advantage at the altitude.
And Adam, for you, you know, I want to see the strongest go through. It's like our entertainment through the group stages. All the teams struggling with altitude and so on. It's unthinkable that they go out, surely.
Well, obviously, I'm hoping that they do go out because I'd prefer to see a Chilean side go through.
This is my revenge for you stopping talking to me.
Well, one thing I do want to point out is that Unión Española have played in La Paz four times and they have three wins and a draw there. So they're unbeaten there. And Chilean sides in general have a strong record in La Paz. The altitude doesn't really affect them. So I think we can take that out of the equation. But Simon's quite right in saying that the strongest this year certainly look a pretty good side. I think even without altitude, they're going to give teams a game, home and away. But I do feel that Unión Española can be dangerous on the counter. They quite often look better away from home than they do at home in the domestic league, simply because they have quite a bit of pace on the counter-attack. That last-minute equaliser, it could prove very handy. You know, the fact that they don't have to chase the game. I know that they're heading out as soon as that game starts because, you know, it's the strongest who have the away goal, but I don't think they have to chase the game like they would do if they were losing 1-0. I think the strongest, yeah, they're one of the strongest, without wanting to do that boring pun there. Bolivian sides that we've seen in this competition in recent years, and they have a fearsome home record in the past few months across all competitions. I think they've only lost something like one of their last 30 games, I think I read earlier today. So it's going to be a fascinating second leg. And I think this was the most interesting tie of the round when we did the preview last week. I echo the thoughts of Simon on Chumacero. He's a player that I've praised on this pod before last year and this. I still find it bizarre that he's playing in Bolivia with performances like he's consistently putting in now in the competition. I don't think it's going to be long before he makes a move to a big club. I think I mentioned that last week, actually. Although he did limp off in this game. And if he is missing for the second leg, then that could make a big difference because he limped off with about 20 minutes to go, I think it was. And that was the one period of the game that Unión Española totally controlled. It was maybe a bit of a coincidence because Martín Palermo, he did get his tactics wrong from the start. And it wasn't really until he brought Pablo Aránguiz on in the midfield that Unión Española really got a stranglehold on the game. You know, he changed his tactics. He kind of started with a bit of a 4-3-3 and went to a 4-4-2. The other thing I wanted to mention about this game, actually, was that Felipe Simón, he was missing in the midfield for Unión Española. He's injured at the moment, and he was really missed. Hopefully, he gets back for the second leg, because I think he could be a match for Chumacero. He's pretty impressive. It's going to be a case of, is Seymour fit for the second leg? Is Chumacero fit for the second leg? And I think that could really decide where this tie goes, because I think both sides are decent. If I had to put money on it, I do favour the strongest. But don't rule out Unión Española.
And Austin, you're a man after my own heart. You want to see the strongest in the group phases. You know, we enjoy our altitude games. What's your thoughts? Anything different? Would you share Adam's concerns?
Yeah, I think both of those guys said a lot about this match and echoed a lot of what I would have said on both sides of it. Chuma Seto has really impressed me in this competition. I'm very intrigued to see what happens with him going forward. You know, obviously, I think he'll stay with the Strongest for as long as Libertadores runs, but then beyond that, it could be interesting. I would just like to point out that this first leg was very Libertadores in the fact that we had a pair of yellow cards handed out in the first 3 minutes. Pablo Escobar got himself a yellow card, I believe, in the first 30 or so seconds, which is just a great way to start a Libertadores match. You know you're in for
nine
a good one.
Seconds.
Nine. How many?
Seconds. Nine.
There we go. Perfect. Anytime you can get that first yellow card in there in about 15 seconds, you know you're in for a good match, good 90 minutes. Always fun to see that. I want to see the Strongest go through. Honestly, if they played the entire tournament at La Paz, I'd be happy because I love watching what it does to teams. I think it's so fascinating. My favorite picture in the history of pictures is Anderson for Internacional, the former Manchester United man, coming to Internacional out of shape on the bench in La Paz after they had to take him off after 35 minutes, just sucking air from this oxygen mask. So I'm intrigued to watch this tie. I'll watch anything that's in La Paz. I would favor the Strongest, but I do think that late equalizer could certainly, as Adam said, allow Union Española to kind of sit back and let this match come to them. And we'll see if the Strongest is able to break them down. Obviously, as both guys said, Chuma Seto is key to this Strongest side. And if he's healthy, I think the Strongest will go through.
No, without a doubt. And you know, the La Paz games is really, you know, it's a small part of what sets this apart. You know, we've watched Champions League this week and so on. For me, I just love Libertadores. It just doesn't have... there's just nothing out there quite like it, quite like the madness of it. You know exactly what you're getting with the Champions League. You never know what you're going to get with a Copa Libertadores. But listen, we can move on a slight little bit and move in. Some of us have some interesting stories to tell. Simon, that you have a story around the new Chapecoense bar that has been opened in Medellin. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
I mean, I think you've kind of said everything that needs to be said, but it's like Medellin was doing so well with this whole Chapecoense thing. It was, you know, they responded in the best way. Everyone was nice. Everyone was like, oh, Medellin, you know, horrible situation, but you've done quite well. You know, we're quite happy. And then people are going too far. They've opened a bar with Chapecoense logos all over it, Chapecoense plaques all inside. It's called the Chapecoense Bar. And it's like, Jesus, guys, like, well, you're going too far.
The mold of the plane, like, like mounted onto the wall, the front of the plane. That was one of the worst taste of things I've ever seen. It was such bad taste, such bad taste.
Yeah, and yeah. You mentioned bad taste there, Adam, and Simon highlights this in South American terms. Like, we live down here. In South American terms, this was done exceptionally. You know, all of the way this whole tragedy was handled to this point was magnificent. And this just, in truth, a South American style, they've reverted the type and just fucked it out of the water, basically.
Well, to be fair, it is probably just sort of one or two idiots who have completely sort of misread the situation. But yeah. Simon did also mention to us that, you know, people are selling Chapecoense shirts and, you know, that, you know, fake ones. So that money's not going to the club either, right?
Yeah, exactly. Everywhere you can buy Chapecoense shirts all over the place. And it's like, and I get it. People have like, so many like these six-a-side teams are wearing Chapecoense kits now, and it's like just a knockoff kit from a backstreet, you know, factory. And it's, you know, fair enough, but it's not like this money's going to Chapecoense, you know. Yeah, I don't know. People try their hardest to do things in the right way, and sometimes they are a bit misguided. Talking about misguided, this new player who's joined Vasco da Gama in Brazil. Andres Escobar. I spoke about Andres Escobar on my 11 Pieces of Me, but this is another Andres Escobar. He's a little winger, been playing in Dynamo Kiev. He just moved to Vasco da Gama. He had his press conference today. And Globo Esporte, one of the journalists from this organization, asked him if he was Pablo's son. You know, just these journalists sitting there kind of going, oh, who's this guy?
Just a distant cousin, maybe.
Yeah. So Andres Escobar is... Is Pablo your dad? It's like the kind of shit you see on a forum. Like,
South American sensitivity comes to the fore once again.
Yeah, and he kind of laughed off and said, oh, yeah, you know, it's a funny situation. You know, I've heard this joke before. Very good, very good. But, yeah, just typical, you know, Colombians. And Colombians are so sensitive about these things. So it's really not the thing to do to bring up a joke about Pablo Escobar, you know, especially as a foreigner. So, yeah, it didn't go down too well. But, yeah, an interesting player. Tiny little guy, very quick winger at Vasco da Gama. And I believe they've also signed Luis Fabiano. Luis Fabiano,
who was last seen in Brazil eternally offside for São Paulo a couple years back. I believe every single match, you could bet Luis Fabiano was getting that flag raised on him about five times because he just didn't want to be onside. Went to China for the money, then got kind of pushed out there because of the foreign limit. They wanted to bring better players than Luis Fabiano. Cannot blame them for that. Vasco are an interesting club. Luis Fabiano is going to be intriguing. I like Nene, their playmaker. But Vasco have been a yo-yo side, and it's hard to see them being anywhere else but right in that fight once again this year, which is just really strange.
Austin, I want to ask you a question, I don't know whether you're getting it from. I know you follow a lot of, you know, a lot of the Portuguese spoken stuff and so on, but and this may sound sensitive, but it's certainly not meant to be. But you know, the tragedy that was the Chapecoense air disaster, it's still reverberating around Brazilian football. And I fear that, you know, and this, again, it just sounds so insensitive, but there's everything is just a commemoration. And it beginning to me here to feel like it's overshadowing the actual football. I don't know, you know, I know that you follow a lot of the Portuguese spoken stuff. Is that transmitting to you the same way?
I think there is some sense of it. You know, I think there does become kind of a saturation point where it kind of hits the spot and you've said, okay, you know, we've honored this. We've had tributes to this. You can only do so much. You know, I think that really the only kind of final hurdle, if you will, left for the Chapecoense side is going to be, you know, I think there's two. It's one, their debut in the Copa Libertadores. I think that's rightfully going to be an incredibly emotional moment. And then the Recopa, the South American Super Cup, when they face Atlético Nacional over two legs. I think that's going to be an occasion, and it absolutely should be. So I think both those clubs deserve to be celebrated. But I do agree with you that beyond that, it kind of feels, you know, as you said, you don't want it to come off as insensitive, and you definitely understand, and everybody's going to cope differently. But at some point, you do have to take that next step and say, all right, there's a football match. We've got to go play it. You know, you've got to move on. And so I do think that we're getting to that point where it doesn't need to consistently be brought up. Because as Simon pointed out, I think with few exceptions, you know, looking at you, Internacional, but for the most part, this was handled incredibly well by Brazilian clubs, by the Brazilian
absolutely
people.
Incredibly so.
Yeah,
incredibly so. And this is why, I think this is what's fueling and channeling the longevity of it, Austin. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have okay, it's only the state championships. Throw away for me. I wouldn't waste my time watching them. But you know, we have the league season starting, and I can just see this overshadowing the football. You know, is it insensitive to feel that way? But as you say, and you rightly say, there reaches a point where absolutely it needs to be remembered. Absolutely it needs to be honored. But at the same time, there's a sport here to continue.
And I think what's going to be so difficult about it is for the Chapecoense team themselves. Because as you said, it feels like, you know, every place Chapecoense goes, they understandably so, they want to do something to honor this memory and to show compassion. But at some point, just for those players that are in this situation, you know, to have that happen every other match, every single time you go away from home, that's going to be incredibly emotional. That's just going to be a lot on them. And it's going to in a sense, you know, kind of drag on them. So I, you know, we said from the start that it would be unlike anything we've ever seen to watch this club kind of rebuild. And because of the state leagues and because they have yet to debut in the Libertadores, they have in some sense kind of gotten to get into themselves and figure out how they want to play and work out formations and lineups. And, you know, Wagner Mancini, their manager, working with an entire new squad. but they're going to come back into the spotlight here shortly, and it's just going to be really interesting to see everything that happens with them, how they handle that, how they play. You know, I think there are some pieces there, but it's just going to be really, really interesting. And as we've said before, you know, it's unprecedented. We don't really have anything to draw off as sort of a comparison.
And as I say, it's not in any way what I said to demean anything of what happened or the great work that has been done. But ultimately, I just fear for Brazil getting hung up on this. Adam, you have any thoughts on that?
I kind of get what you mean, Dave. I think Austin summed it up well. You know, that saturation point has probably been reached, and there's kind of, you know, as Austin outlined, you know, those two big events coming up, the debut in the Copa Libertadores and also the Recopa Sudamericana final over two legs. You know, they're rightfully going to be emotional occasions, but I'm pretty sure the club themselves would just like to move on now. So everybody sort of bringing it up every 5 minutes isn't going to help them very much. So I think it's best that, you know, the mentions of the plane crash from now on are kept to a minimum, unless it's really sort of necessary to point it out.
Yeah, and Simon, you know, obviously we all live in South America. They're a very emotional, very passionate people, and in this sense, you just get a feeling that they're trundle on, and the emotion is just going to carry it on. In Medellin at the moment, is there still that amount of emotion that still exists here in Brazil?
I mean, yes and no. I think it's kind of at that awkward period now where people are sometimes wanting to be seen to be expressing their grief publicly still, and it's kind of everyone instinctively responded in the best possible way. And now there's, you know, there's one-upmanship, you know, we're grieving. I don't know. It's sometimes it borders on the insincere, which is, you know, again, is just a really awkward position to be in. And, you know, for example, this bar in Medellin, and it's, you know, that's just, you're not doing it right. And again, it's not for me to tell people how to respond to a tragedy. And obviously people are going to still be suffering personally. But when big organizations, when public statements are made, you know, as I think has been said really well, there's these two big landmark moments now in the story of this tragedy. Those should be remembered and treated in the best possible way. But yeah, I think everyone's right in terms of, you know, let this team now start building its new history and its future. And, you know, there will be obviously be moments in the future to look back and reflect on this. But I think now the best way to respond is to look at what the team's doing and the community's doing positively to move forward.
Indeed. And back to yourself, Adam, what madness do you have for us from Chile this week? Anything exciting?
No, not too much madness, actually. But one thing maybe to look out for is the fact that Iquique, one of the Chile's representatives in the Copa Libertadores this year, they've had an amazing start to the season. 3 wins out of 3. They've won 2 of those games at home fairly comfortably. The one in between was an away game where they were 2-0 down with about half an hour to go, and they managed to win 3-2, scoring the last-minute winner. So it'd be interesting if they can maybe carry over that form to the Copa Libertadores. They kick off on the 7th of March. You know, it'll be fascinating to see whether they can sort of manage the two competitions as well, because they've got a fairly small squad, being, you know, one of the smaller clubs here in Chile. And another update really is just on Colo-Colo, who disappointed in the Copa Libertadores last week, but, you know, they've smashed another opponent in the league here. Audax Italiano were the victims this weekend. So it's 2 wins out of 2 for them, both really comfortable wins as well. There was also dodgy starts from Universidad de Chile and champions Universidad Católica. But I'd like to mention Universidad Chile changed their manager again this season, and it just doesn't look like there's been any improvement there, really. They still look completely lacking in fight and ideas. Champions Universidad Católica, they did start last season slowly as well before ending up winning the title, so I'm not sure how much we can read into that, but they are struggling for goals. You know, they did lose Nico Castillo to Pumas in Mexico. I fear that maybe they haven't got quite the attacking talent that they had last year, which is a shame. But let's wait and see how they get on in a couple of weeks' time.
No, and indeed, Austin, I'm going to come back to yourself because I know that you have some Brazilian madness for us from Fluminense. only in Brazil. Go ahead.
Yeah, we actually saw this last year with Independiente del Valle in the Copa Libertadores, where they were actually scheduled to play two matches on the same day, and they went through and they played them.
Fluminense, no problem.
Fluminense could be in a similar situation here. They asked that their next Copa do Brasil match, which is in the second round of the tournament, so still playing an incredibly small club, be moved from February 28th to March 1st. The reasoning being, of course, or February 22nd rather, to March 1st. The reasoning being, of course, that February 22nd is far too close to Carnival. Can't be playing anywhere close to Carnival. That's the one time that we'll actually take off here in Brazil.
Next week. Yeah. It actually started. The Bloco started in Rio last weekend, and it's here next week. So if listeners, well, our South American show will be fine, I would say, but some of your shows may be a little delayed next week.
But the problem was that the date that the CBF rescheduled it for, Fluminense have a match in the Copa Primeira Liga, which was started in an effort to be a competitor to the state leagues. That has really kind of flopped in its second year now. Teams haven't taken it particularly seriously. So it'll be interesting to see. Fluminense decided that they're going to play both on the same day, if they'll try to get the Primeira Liga game moved, or if they'll just go through with it. You never know. You never know what you're going to see in Brazil here.
No, well, that's true. Well, talking of things we never thought we'd see in Brazil, and, you know, I love putting this to you because I'm going to talk about Sao Paulo and, you know, your little favorites. And, you know, Michael Bale came from England and is basically assistant coach down there at the moment. But what we're seeing is an almost rejuvenated Sao Paulo side, Austin.
Yeah, yeah. This is a Sao Paulo side that regular listeners of this podcast will know was certainly not my favorite last year. I would assume not your favorite either. But it's state leagues, so you certainly want to take it with a grain of salt. They also opened the state leagues with a 4-2 loss to Audax from Sao Paulo, which is a small club that was very successful last year. But under Rogério Ceni, they've been successful. I like a lot of their pieces, and their biggest hole for me coming into this year was at goalkeeper and as a striker. And they brought in a solid goalkeeper in Sidão from Botafogo, who played for Audax last year in the state leagues. And they filled their hole at the number 9 with Lucas Prato, the Argentinian who was at Atlético Mineiro, got kind of pushed out the door by Freji being there, and there just simply wasn't enough space, and they couldn't play together. I like Christian Cueva, the Peruvian midfielder. I think they've improved their defense. You know, I think Rodrigo Caio is a good center back. And there's some good pieces on this Sao Paulo side. So it'll be interesting to watch how they develop. You know, what sense of time is Rogério Ceni given in charge for them? I think he was smart in that his two assistants are Michael Beale, the Englishman, and another Frenchman. So he's going outside of Brazil to kind of bring in different influences for these guys. Sao Paulo have a decent number of non-Brazilian players. They have the limit of 5 that you can have in the Brazilian league play on any given match day. You know, so I'm very curious to see how this side develops. And from where I sit right now, I think they'll have a better season than crosstown rival Corinthians will have from where looking at the two sides as they're currently constructed and as they're currently playing.
Well, hopefully we'll have a Corinthians fan here to tell us next week or maybe the week after. Adam, I know you've been impressed by the form of them. You spoke to me about it during the week. As I said, I along the same lines, of my response was the same basically as what Austin has said, state leagues, throw it away. But they have looked a bit impressive.
Yeah, I watched some of their highlights against Santos in a state league match, and they looked very interesting indeed. Like you guys said, I think that the fact that their manager, the legendary goalkeeper for them as well, Rogério Ceni, he's really brought some interesting ideas to the club, and I'm fascinated to see how it's gonna pan out.
So, Simon, you know, obviously, you know, there in Colombia, you have contacts with maybe other Englishmen who have come down to South America. Can you see this becoming a trend? Do you think we might see more in the future?
It's difficult to say. I mean, obviously, at my local team, there's a player, George Saunders, who's from England, moved to Spain and then ended up in Colombia with America de Cali and now with Envigado. You know, we'll have to see. I think there are certain aspects of the European game that would be welcome in terms of coaching here in Colombia. The technical level is incredibly high here, but for me, young players in terms of movement off the ball, in terms of talking, in terms of, you know, some of the simple things that are very much drilled heavily in England are not as heavily, you know, heavily focused upon here in South America. So I think there are certain aspects that could, from European football, from English football, that could really help young players. For me, the biggest thing, movement off the ball, players who pass the ball and stand still. And again, that, you know, that isn't necessarily how Colombian football is played at the top level, but with young players, that confidence, that talking, that communication, there's not enough emphasis on that. But again, Colombian coaches are quite proud, and they don't necessarily see, while there's a lot of respect for European football, and obviously everyone watches this as the Champions League, there's not necessarily a real prestige placed on English coaches. And I would say to some extent, rightfully so. I mean, I wouldn't imagine many English, Italian coaches, Spanish coaches are going to go and watch a Sam Allardyce or a Mark Hughes training session necessarily. But again, I think generally European football could have a positive impact on things here in South America. And for example, my local team, Envigado, now has a Spanish manager. He was managing in the fourth division in Spain. He's taken over Envigado, and there's a notable difference in terms of the organization and some of the structure. So I think having a greater influence of English and perhaps European football in general here in Colombia could have a positive impact, not on the coaching of technique, but on the coaching of strategy and collective play and talking and movement. Some of the basic things which, you know, could really make big strides with the natural technical ability that a lot of the Colombian players have down here.
No, indeed. And I believe you have some ladies football for us as well, Simon, kicking off down there this week.
Yeah, so tonight, which is Friday for us here recording, the first Colombian women's league game was played, which is a huge step. Cortaluá beat Pasto. I'm not going to be giving weekly updates, but in terms of Colombian football as a whole, both male and female, this is a massive, massive step. And it's been treated quite seriously. The league basically said, we need a women's league. The professional men's clubs had to set up women's teams. And it's really forced a welcome change very quickly. So now, this weekend, every team in Colombia will have a women's team playing a league match. It's divided up into groups, regional groups. And a lot of the big players are coming back. Daniela Montoya, who was the standout women's player for Colombia at the Women's World Cup, scored an absolute screamer. She's playing for my local team, Envigado. She's really good. I've played against her. And before the game, some of the guys were saying, you know, so what's the deal? Can we tackle these girls? Nobody got anywhere near her. So there's some real talented players down here. Women's football is becoming, you know, it's quite popular, six-a-side mostly, but it's nice that there's now the progression. The Colombian national women's team has had its moments, but has had a lack of organization, which obviously is going to come now with a more structured league and regular competitive games. And it's nice to see that it's been well received. People are very happy to see it coming in. There hasn't been too many sexist comments. You know, obviously, when you sometimes check women's football, you know, articles, and even in the UK, a lot of sexist, dismissive, oh, it's just women. But honestly, I've been really pleasantly surprised in a macho culture. The people have taken responded really well to this news, and I've seen very little cynicism. So looking forward to seeing how the league develops. I might go down and watch a few games. There's some good players down here, and hopefully with time, this can be something that helps the game in the country.
No, indeed. And that's an interesting point. Adam, I believe we're going to go now and have a word. You spoke with Tom Robinson earlier on in the week about the under-20s. Do you want to tell us and introduce that little piece for us?
Sure. I spoke to Tom Robinson yesterday about the under-20 South American Championships, which came to an end last weekend. You'll hear all about that in a minute. First of all, I just want to hear Austin and Simon's thoughts on the disappointing performances from Brazil and Colombia, with both missing out on a place in the World Cup taking place this year.
Brazil did not impress me at any point during this tournament, and so it doesn't come as a huge surprise given the way they played. You know, anytime a Brazilian youth team doesn't make the World Cup, it's certainly a failure. Those are the goals of these teams, obviously. I felt that they probably could have still snuck their way in, kind of like they did in 2015. And then when they got to the under 20 World Cup, they went and they made the final after a similar performance in the South American tournament. But they just weren't particularly impressive. And they blew a couple leads. They let Argentina peg them back at the end. And then they couldn't win a match when they needed to get in at the very last. So, you know, they didn't make it and they probably weren't deserving to have made it anyway. So it's a disappointment for Brazil. It's another 2 years now before they get another shot at it. But I think the three of the South American teams that went through over them certainly deserve it. Argentina were probably lucky that it was them and not Brazil that's that fourth team. But, you know, credit to the Argentines for battling back and getting that draw against Brazil that ultimately propelled them through.
Yeah, and in terms of Colombia, there were a couple of players who looked quite interesting. Juan Camilo Hernandez got it together towards the end of the tournament, looked okay. You know, a couple of players here and there. Seta obviously got injured, but he looked decent. Eva Valencia was a surprise, impressive couple of performances. But a lot of the criticism here in Colombia has come to the manager as well, Carlos Restrepo. There's been for a few years a sense that he's not quite getting the best out of the team. Questions over some of the selections. So obviously disappointing that Colombia didn't make it through to qualify. I think there are some good players in Colombia, and I think there's good players who weren't included in this tournament. So I think overall the picture is still positive in regards to youth players coming through in Colombia. But obviously this tournament was very flat from Colombia, underwhelming, some disappointing results, some, you know, so generally not particularly great, but a couple of standout performances. And I think the picture overall is brighter than was shown at this particular tournament.
Right. Well, I think on that point, we'll just move on into the interview then with Tom.
We've got you on the show today to talk about the South American Under 20 Championships, which just ended in Ecuador a few days ago. Uruguay came out on top. I don't think that's much of a surprise to us. You know, in the preview of this championships we did, you know, I think we both fancied them to certainly challenge and maybe win this title, which they did. It's their first for 36 years, so they're obviously delighted to come out on top. So a word on the champions, first of all.
As we've said before on the previous pods, they were one of our pre-tournament favourites. They looked the strongest team after the group stage, and they continued that with four wins and one sort of freak loss to Venezuela to top the group with 12 points. It was really impressive throughout from them. They've just sort of grown as the tournament's gone on. They've obviously got great attacking talent up front with Amaral, Chapacase, and Nicolas de la Cruz, who for my money was probably the star player overall in terms of consistent performances for Uruguay. And yeah, they've also got that sort of standard solidity at the back. Maybe not sort of a great standout name like they've had Jimenez and Lemos in the past, but their keeper was good. Rogel was probably the best of the defenders. Their left back, Oliveira, was quite good. And in the middle, yeah, they played some good passing football, maybe a bit more guile and creativity than your usual kind of Uruguayan pit bulls that you're used to with Betancourt and Waller, especially. They were both good and they chipped in with plenty of assists. So yeah, it's no surprise really to see them come out on top, and they sort of comprehensively beat Colombia 3-0. They beat Argentina 3-0. Also beat Ecuador, who were the sort of the second place team, 2-1 with pretty much a reserve side. So it showed good strength and depth. And I think out of the entire tournament, they're the ones that you'd think could go on and actually maybe do something at the Under 20 World Cup.
Yeah, you spoke a bit there about Nicolas de la Cruz. He's the captain as well of the. Was he captain for this tournament or was it Amaral?
It was mainly Amaral, but I mean, we've talked about how our admiration for him, and along with the weight issues and the fact that he got subbed off in every single game he started, definitely shows a stamina issue. And a lot of the time it was De La Cruz who would pick up that creative impetus once Amaral had kind of huffed and puffed and gone off.
I kind of noticed that those two were kind of, you know, battling to be kind of the key player in the side almost. And I think they pushed each other on during the tournament. I think it helped Uruguay to have such a good tournament. I see that De La Cruz is the brother of Carlos Sanchez, the Uruguayan international who's impressed in recent years. Looks like there's quite a lot of talent in that family.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, Carlos Sanchez was an absolute key part of Marcelo Gallardo's Riverside that won the Sudamericana and Libertadores. And De La Cruz has been gathering quite a bit of momentum in the last few years. He was a big part of the under 17 side a couple of years ago, and he was part of he plays for Liverpool in Montevideo, and their under 20 side I think reached the Libertadores under 20s final, only to lose to Sao Paulo. So he's been doing quite well, and he really looks for like a future international, senior international, and maybe one that before the tournament not as many people would have been as aware of. So yeah, I think his stock's definitely risen quite a bit.
Yeah, I think those two, Amaral and De La Cruz, could be the real deal. Moving on to talk about the hosts. I said on the pod that we did, the preview, that the home advantage may prove be key for them. I'm not sure that's the sole reason they qualified for the under 20 World Cup. I think they have some very talented players. Brian Cabezas, for example. You know, he was a favourite of the Copa Libertadores show that we did last year, and he was the obvious star of this side. What did you make of Ecuador overall, and who stood out for you?
Yeah, I definitely agree that it was more than home advantage that got them through. As with the sort of senior side, we've seen them produce a lot of very rapid, direct forwards, and that's basically what their team was all about. I think they were the highest scorer in the hexagonal phase, and you know, in the group stage they had that 4-3 victory over Colombia, which kind of shows you exactly their style of play. It was thrilling going forward and occasionally a bit ropey at the back, but Cabezas, even though he's not really done much at Atalanta since moving from Independiente del Valle, that was a timely reminder of just how talented he is. He got 5 goals, he was joint top scorer at the end, and he got a few assists as well. And he formed a great partnership with Pervis Estupiñán.
One of the best names of the...
Yeah. great name. And again, he was a very attack-minded fullback. And he's part of the Granada, Udinese, Watford. I don't know which club he's technically at right now. But one of the Pozzo family clubs. And he scored 4 goals. Admittedly, 3 of those were penalties, but... As you know, in knockout football, that can be important. So he's definitely a strong character within the team. Yeah, they had good players all around. They had Washington Corozo and Hernan Lino up front, who's kind of alternated with Jordi Caicedo, and they all chipped in with goals. And, you know, they were just sort of constantly hounding defences. They were very quick and initiated the press very well. Also, Joao Rojas, he started the tournament very well, but kind of tailed off a little bit. But he, again, was a tricky sort of attacking midfielder who contributed to the side, and Jordan Sierra as well deserves a mention in the middle of the park. He was full of energy, and I think generally speaking, like physically, they were probably one of the best prepared sides. Obviously, home advantage would have helped with that, but I think they just had that pace and power that really got them over the line.
Yeah, I remember reading before the tournament that they had sort of various training camps and all that. There was a real push to get this side to the World Cup. I think they realised, you know, that this was going to be a great chance to make it to an under-20 World Cup. Let's move on to talk about Venezuela. They impressed us both in their hexagonal, and they were even more impressive in the final round, especially in their demolitions of Uruguay and Ecuador. They could be a bit Jekyll and Hyde at times, but generally, for me, they were kind of the biggest surprise of this tournament. And I have to say, I can't wait to see Jefferson Soltaro here in Chile this year. He signed for Huachipato, as you mentioned, in the pre-tournament. So yeah, I'm really excited to see him now. And what did you think of them overall? You know, a couple of their players have already been signed by bigger clubs off the back of this tournament, I see.
I thought they were great. As you mentioned, definitely the surprise package that no one really had down as definitely qualifying for the World Cup. That was a massive achievement. I think it's only the second time in their history, so it shows you what a massive achievement it was for them. And they kind of made it through the group stages by drawing all their games and only scoring 1 goal. And you kind of feared that against maybe the tougher sides that they might struggle. But as you mentioned, they beat Ecuador, they beat Uruguay. probably the two best teams there. So they've got that ability to counterattack well and beat them. I think the win against Ecuador was a bit of an odd one because there was just so much fog all over the pitch that they really sort of punished Ecuador in about a 30-minute spell, if memory serves me, and Soteldo kind of scampering underneath all the fog and doing well. So
yeah, I think the Ecuadorians wanted to call it off. From what I could see, it was that bad.
They would have been better off doing that, I think. But generally speaking, they were very solid defensively. They had a great spine to their team with Wilker Fariñez, who I know Austin and some of the other guys have been raving about. He's a really good young keeper. The one maybe doubt you'd have about him is he quite tall enough to go on to be like a top keeper? But he was the best keeper at the tournament. And he was really solid, and it all stemmed from him, really. And Ronald Hernandez, I think it was, at right back, was probably one of the better right backs in the tournament. And generally, the defense was solid. And then one of my favorite players, probably the biggest revelation for me, was Yangel Herrera, who was their box-to-box midfield captain, all-action, no-nonsense type of player. And he's actually been signed by Man City and then loaned to New York. So yeah, he's got a big move off the back of it. And then, as you mentioned, Soteldo is just an absolute joy to watch. Lovely diminutive playmaker, and he really stepped up in the hexagonal stage and got three goals overall. So he really gave them that clinical cutting edge that they'd been lacking during the group stage. Peña and Chacon worked very hard. They're not the most prolific strikers, so it was mainly down to that spine of Fariñez, Herrera and Soteldo. But yeah, it's great to have them at the World Cup, and I think it was also important that they had the national team boss Rafael Dudamel on the sidelines. He was very vocal about the sort of bias against them when they lost to Brazil 1-0 with a very controversial goal. Yeah, I think his presence would have spurred them on. And I think in the bigger picture, if you look at some of the players they've produced in the last 5 to 7 years, they've got the makings of a really strong national senior team and that could go on and maybe make a maiden World Cup. So yeah, it's all looking very rosy for the Vino Tinto.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Argentina, one word is perhaps lucky, I think.
Yeah, I mean that's even generous, but they managed to sneak in there, level on points with Ecuador and Venezuela, but with a -3 goal difference, which shows you kind of how well they did. They basically, it all came down to their Clásico with Brazil, and they managed to snatch a last-minute goal through Lautaro Martinez, who is, I think, one of the best strikers in the tournament. He scored 5 goals and was joint top scorer.
Clinical, wasn't he, Martinez? Yeah, that was the impressive thing about him.
He popped up at really crucial moments as well. I think in about 3 games, he scored in the last minute or in injury time. Without those goals, they would have lost vital points and definitely been nowhere near qualifying. So they managed to draw with Brazil, and then it came down to they had to beat Venezuela and hope that Brazil didn't beat Colombia, who were already eliminated. Their sort of fate wasn't even in their own hands, but they got a 2-0 win over Venezuela, who knew they were through already. And then, as I'm sure you're going to talk about, Brazil could only contrive to draw 0-0 with Colombia. And against all odds, Argentina went through. But as we were saying, it's not really something to celebrate because it just papers over the absolutely massive cracks in the Argentinian youth system right now. They showed lots of ill discipline, didn't really have much tactical nous. Even if you look at the way their coach Claudio Vera was appointed before the tournament, basically it was a case of all these managers and coaches submitting their projects for the youth setup. I think there was about 40 odd people who applied. And then when it was announced, Ubeda got the job, but he hadn't actually submitted anything. So that just shows you what a shambles it is behind the scenes. And Argentina were very lucky to get through.
Yeah, a real shambles at youth level in Argentina at the moment. I remember the mess in the Olympics as well last year. I think it could be a worrying few years ahead for Argentina. As much as the talent's there, I think the organisation could really let them down in the coming years.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, especially after they had that kind of golden age between 1997 and about 2007, they were just clearing up at this level. In the sort of decade since then, it's been really poor, and they're sort of just relying on the attacking talents that they continue to produce to kind of bail them out of tricky situations. Martinez, as we mentioned, was very impressive in how clinical he was. Torres was a nice surprise. He did very well, but mainly in the group stages against lesser opponents. And apart from that, really, you had Tomáš Konečný, who was very good from set pieces, and you know, he didn't maybe get amongst the goals as he's more used to at under 17 level, but he made an impact, and so did Brian Mancisa, who I think Ajax had a $7 million bid rejected by Racing, so he's obviously another one who impressed. But it was kind of the big names like Ascasibar was a bit underwhelming, and Ezequiel Barco, who we're expecting big things from, he had a terrible tournament. So realistically, there's a few attacking guys to watch out for at the World Cup, but defensively they're just really struggling to produce anyone.
Sure, and a quick word on Brazil and Colombia before you go. Both were really disappointing, especially in this round. I'm going to talk more about them with Austin and Simon, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think Brazil were the biggest disappointment, really, because they had the players to qualify, and they sort of showed a knack of letting leads slip and just not really sensing that impetus to kill matches. I think they still had a number of players who emerged with some credit. Felipe Vezu was good up front, big burly striker. Richarlison was a constant threat. I really liked Lianco, the centre-back who had previously played for Serbia under 19s. I think that's an interesting story, and also just a good player to watch out for. Yeah, there's some good individual performances, but in terms of a team sense, it never really clicked, and they never got out of first gear. Colombia were kind of another example of that as well, just kind of no clear idea and sort of lacking a bit of threat going forward. I think Juan Camilo Hernandez did very well to try and force the issue up front, but ever since the injury to Damir Seta, he was kind of forced into a more lone striker role, when really he's better as a support striker or a number 10. So I think his influence was maybe limited, and he was left isolated. They just couldn't really get the service to him. Some decent performances from Atuesta and Eva Valencia and Carlos Cuesta at the back. They just absolutely limped out of the tournament. I think the 3-0 loss to Uruguay just really killed their spirit, and they did all right to draw against Brazil in the end, but they'll be disappointed not to have made more of a challenge of getting one of those qualification spots.
Sure. Well, thanks for coming on, Tom. Just, I guess, one quick question before you go. You know, who would you pick out as your player of the tournament? Or if it's not the same, who do you think will go on to sort of be the next big thing?
Probably the player of the tournament would have to go to either Amaral or De La Cruz. I think I would love to see Amaral go on and become a world beater, because I think he has that potential. We'll have to see how he sorts out his physique, let's put it that way. I think De La Cruz has a very strong future ahead of him as well. If I had to put money on someone to have a really big impact, I still think Juan Camilo Hernandez can be someone who is at a massive club in a few years' time. He's still only 17, and even though he was in a really disappointing side, he showed a lot of fight and a lot of invention and creativity. Yeah, he's one that I think will go on to big things. I'd like to see some of the Venezuelans as well go on to be national team mainstays for the next 10-15 years. But yeah, I think there's plenty of players who could who could go on and have very good careers, particularly from the Uruguay team. But I don't think we've seen a Neymar or someone like that this year.
Okay, well, thanks so much again for coming on, Tom, and see you later.
Thanks, always a pleasure.
Right, okay, just before we close, guys, we had put a survey out during the week of some feedback on WFI, and what has come back in, for this show in particular has been, you know, it's breathtaking, really. We didn't realize just how appreciated we are here, and certainly the little areas of feedback that we've got, we'll certainly be trying to act on them. I think Adam will have a little bit on that later. But, you know, obviously we're in the process also of building a new website. Hopefully it'll be released next month. And, you know, the guys here are already working on articles for Copa Libertadores and so on. So we're hoping to explode that little bit of content. WFI was founded basically with a South American flair, and basically we want to keep that very much to the fore. As I say, we've got some new people, some new faces to get involved, hopefully in the South American football show over the next little while. Lads from Ecuador and a young lady from Brazil who wants to come on and talk to us as well. So again, having people who are actually natives of the country as well is a massive thing for us as well. Certainly from some of the feedback, that's the area you feel that we're strong in, the fact that we live down here. The area of weakness, I would say, for us, and I'm sure, Adam, you'd probably agree, is, you know, we're only here a short time. We don't have the ingrained birth here and you know, into that football culture, ingrained into these teams, and I think that's where maybe having some of these guys on will even raise it to another level.
Sure. And if you're a South American that listens to this show and you're fluent in English, which if you're listening to this show I'm sure you are, you know, you're welcome on any time, really. So just get in touch with me and Dave, and we'll have something for you. But I know that we've talked about this, that the podcast is probably going to go into a couple of different directions over the next couple of months. You're going to have your Copa Libertadores podcast, but we're also going to have sort of a South American football show, which is more sort of about the culture here in South America rather than not beyond the field football stuff. So plenty to look forward to. A couple other things I'm going to mention soon as well. I'll hand back to you, Dave, for now.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was something that, you know, Simon had actually brought to us about, you know, the culture of actually attending games and going to football and what it means to the people as well. And sometimes, you know, we just expect everybody to know because we're here. But I think, Simon, you know, some of the things that you brought there, it would be nice to bring the flavour, maybe not just talk about on the field, all of the build-up, what football actually means to communities here, I think, as well, would be a nice touch to bring.
Again, football here is so much more than on the field. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so interesting to follow the Libertadores. The Champions League, you know, there's obviously different stadiums and different aspects. But here, everything surrounding the game, from the crowds, to the chants, to the politics, to the social aspects, to the, you know, the way that football impacts upon the lives of everyone across the city, across the country, I think it'd be really interesting to make sure we put some of these on the field developments within their true context, and really explore what South American football means, how it impacts upon society, and how society impacts upon the game itself that you guys can follow, you know, wherever you are in the world. So I think it's important to give that context, and it's a lot of fun for me. It's something I'm really looking forward to doing in terms of exploring how different countries live football in South America.
And also, like, it's totally entertaining because we're going to tell you and talk about things that just seem completely alien in the rest of the world. But listen, I, mindful of time here, I just want to thank the guys and run around the table. Adam, I know that you want to plug something that we're bringing back off the back of the feedback that we got. So floor is yours. Where can we find you? All the biz.
Well, first off, yeah, you can find me at Kanija Scores on Twitter. If you want to get in touch with me about anything, really, let me know on there. As you mentioned, Dave, you know, a favourite of the World Football Index is coming back, a favourite pod of ours, and that's the World Cup pod. So we're going to be taking a look back at all the World Cups which have taken place in the past. I believe that we're going to look at the 2006 World Cup in Germany this week. We're going to be speaking to Manuel Veff and Andrew Flint about that.
Yeah, we're putting an Englishman in to keep him on a leash sort of thing. to keep the balance in, we're putting an Englishman in.
Yeah, that, So, and that's a podcast, you know, close to my heart. I absolutely adore the World Cup. Those who listened to my 11 Pieces of Me a couple of weeks ago, you know, Italia 90 is how I got into football in a major way, really. And the 1962 Chile podcast that I did was my first podcast with you guys. And I found that through searching for Tim Bickery on iTunes, who had done a 1958 World Cup podcast with us, which is always a brilliant timeless listen on our feed. So if you haven't heard those podcasts, go check them out. And I hope that you enjoy the rest of the series that we bring to you.
Indeed. And I think what I'll do this week is I'll repost those to put them back to the top, towards the top of the timeline for people who maybe missed them the first time, because it is a long time ago. And they'll say there's an epic doubleheader basically on Italia 90, given the fact that that World Cup was just so magnificent. You know, it truly was. But where can we find you on Twitter, Adam? So, Austin, your shout-outs, where can we find you? What are you working on apart from World Football? Apart from World Football Index?
I am at Austin_James906 on Twitter. As always, live-tweeting Libertadores, a little bit of Brazilian State League action. Yes, I know not many people care, but I do like to watch Palmeiras play, and they do play in that, so do that. But I am excited for them to debut in a real competition in the Libertadores in just a couple weeks. Other than that, you know, I'm excited to get back to working and doing a lot more football things. My schedule here will open up in the next couple of weeks. So looking to jump back into it and get a lot more than just the odd Libertadores podcast here and then. So really excited for it.
Indeed. And, you know, just coming to Simon, and, you know, whenever you listen to your 11 Pieces of Me, and I keep bringing this up, because there was more feedback that we got along the lines of Neymar is God, why do I slate Neymar, and please stop, and please more of Neymar. It ain't happening. You're a pack of fucking clowns. Stop it. It's not happening. The more that you push Neymar my direction, the opposite direction I go.
What does that have to do with Simon? You brought up Simon, and then you just went into your own Neymar rant.
The impetuousness of youth. If you be quiet a minute, you'll find out. Because Gavin Haverty on 11 Pieces of Me will explain to you why Neymar is shit. And he watches him every week. So there we go. Simon, where can we find you? And what are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, choosing Neymar as my left back was strange choice, but it had to be done. And obviously, it upset you guys picking Neymar. And I didn't really pick Neymar in my 11 Pieces of Me. I'm on at Twitter at Simon Edwards SAF. Check out my 11 Pieces of Me. I just talk about how much I love playmakers over and over again, and then I'm forced to squeeze in a few defenders and a goalkeeper. But that's fun. So check that out on Waffleman Index.
Some great names come up in there, some great memories in it as well for me personally. But anyway, for me, I just want to plug all of the pods on WFI at the minute. Our Football Grad pod has ruined my street credibility with the Liverpool community this week, because I woke up the other morning to be followed by 50 Evertonians, which doesn't really go well whenever you're a Liverpool fan. So thanks to everybody for following me, but as I say, my street cred's gone down a bit. So if you haven't checked that pod out, it's actually absolutely fascinating on Russian oligarchs and their involvement with Everton Football Club in England. It's a fascinating listen. I urge you to listen to it. And as always, we have La Liga, Serie A, we have Champions League out this week, VPL out this week, all the usual shows. We're going to be doing a question and answers for tactics next week. So if you want to forward us any questions for Stevie Grieve, please feel free to do so. I just want to thank the guys one last time for, as always, it's always one of my favorite pods in the week, if not the favorite pod of the week, chatting South America with these guys. So until next week, just leaves me to say thank you to the listener and goodbye. And Neymar shit. There we go.